Parshas Vayechi. The Rav says, in Talmudic and Midrashic literature, Yaakov is often called Yisrael Saba. And this term, too, is employed even in modern usage to designate Jews who observe the old tradition, Yisrael Saba. In what manner did Yaakov distinguish himself that his name became the generic name for an entire people? And why is he in particular called the Zaken, that term Zaken we use by Yaakov? Yaakov was the first patriarch to establish direct communication with his grandchildren. He was the first to make a historic pronouncement, thereby laying the foundation for the dialogue of the generations. He literally conquered time and space when he said to Yosef, "Your two sons, who were born to you in the land of Egypt, until before I came to you to the land, they are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine like Reuven and Shimon." They received portions in a later division of the land of Israel, as did Yaakov's own sons. Though a second generation removed and nurtured in an Egyptian environment, Yaakov equated them with his own children, who had been reared close to him in Israel, in Canaan. Avram and Yitzhak transmitted their spiritual heritage to their sons, however, but not to their grandsons. The latter received it from their fathers, but there was no direct communication between Avram and Yaakov, or between Yitzhak and Reuven and Shimon. The influence of the grandfathers on their grandchildren was indirect. Yaakov, however, he related directly to his grandchildren. He did not need an intermediary or an interpreter. His was a direct dialogue. Yaakov the Zaken, he leapt over the gulf of generations, and he transmitted the great Mesorah of Avraham directly to Ephraim and Manasseh. Yaakov was the first to impart special blessings to his grandchildren. Right, Hamalach Goel Yevorech Es Na'arim. He blessed them even before he assembled his own sons for their own blessings. He embraced his grandchildren between his knees and he placed his hands upon their heads, symbolically signifying that there was a direct transmission from Yaakov directly to Ephraim and Manasseh. There was no generation gap in the Beis Yaakov. The halachic ruling of B'nei Banim Hareihem Kivanim, grandchildren, they have the same status as children, it was derived from Yaakov's declaration about Ephraim and Manasseh. How appropriate, therefore, that our people are called Yisrael or Yaakov. For it was Yaakov who created the community which ensures the Mesorah, which ensures Jewish continuity. What preceded him were patriarchal families, but Yaakov laid the foundation for a people, for a nation, through the covenant. Though the covenant was made initially with Avraham, it was not until Yaakov that the secret of the perpetuation of the Mesorah was discovered. It says, "Ha'elokim haroe osi," the God. What is haroe? Not that shepherded, but that befriended me. The Ramban in his commentary elucidates that the term haroa is derived from the word rea, friend. In this vein, Rashi in Masechta Shabbos explains the famous comment of Hillel to the potential convert that the essence of the whole Torah is that one should not do to one's friend what he wouldn't want done to himself. The friend, it refers to God himself. In this sense, God is described as being a member of the group, as it were, a friend and a comrade. There is no sense of rule from above, of transcendence, of absolute supremacy, of royal pride or inaccessibility. Hashem's kingdom in Israel is permeated with intimacy and closeness. The phrase Teruas Melech, the friendship of the king, that's what when Bilam described the relationship between Hashem and Am Yisrael. Teruas Melech, the friendship of the king, should be understood as a theocomradeship, symbolizing a God-man community. We're going now to where it says about Yehuda. Yaakov's in the bracha to Yehuda says, "Kara ravatz ke'aryeh uchlavi mi yikimenu." He crouched, he rested like a lion, and like a lion, who will arouse him? Yehuda was a son of Leah. His personality radiated power, authority, and prestige as a lion. He was the invincible warrior who relentlessly pursues his enemies. The Kutzker Rebbe interpreted this verse differently. Yehuda is a lion not only when he stands upright, but even when he falls, even when he makes a mistake. Who could rouse Yehuda from his fall? No one but Yehuda himself could have helped him to rise again. Yehuda is self-asserting, valiant, and fearless. He personifies human dignity and human majesty. At Joseph's cell, Yehuda acted not like a lion, but he acted like a coward. However, he rose by himself, without anyone extending a helping hand. He sinned, but he repented with a contrite heart. He was not embarrassed to publicly confess, to admit the truth in front of all of his friends and associates by saying, "Tzadka mimeni, she is more righteous than I," confessing that she was more righteous than he was. It describes Yosef in his relationship with the brothers, vayimaruhu, they embittered him, verobu, they were numerous than he was, vayistimuhu, they were hostile to him. You could say verobu is not just that they were more numerous than he was, you could say that they quarreled with him, they fought with him. But that's the description. Aristotle said that man is a social animal who is prone to society's ways and mores. Man does not want to stand out and expose himself to an isolation which can often breed antagonism. Yosef, however, he did not act in consonance with this rule. Yosef's brothers hated him primarily because he stood out. His contemporaries could not understand his dreams of sheaves of wheat, speaking of a different economy. They resented his strangeness and singular way of seeing things and events much more than the egocentricity which they wrongly imputed to him. It says, Vayechal Yaakov litzavos esbanav, that Yaakov concluded, what's litzavos esbanav? So we always translate it as commanding his children. The word tzava refers to one's final message, addressed to one's family and friends, signifying a transfer of authority. When Moshe transferred authority to Yoshua, the Torah records, Kaches Yoshua vitzivisa oso le'enehem. The word tziva generally has a connotation to command, but in this context, it refers to the transfer of authority. The Rambam interprets the phrase HaTorah v'Hamitzvah. It's a Torah and Mitzvah is a description in Perek Chaf Dalet Pasuk Yud Beis of Sefer Shemos. The word Torah referring to the Torah Shebichsav, while the word Mitzvah refers to the Torah Shebal Peh, the oral law. The Rambam thus interprets Mitzvah from the word Tziva, from the root Tziva, not in the sense of a commandment, but in the sense of a tradition to be handed down to the next generation. In the last message which Yaakov delivered to his children, he characterizes each son, assigning each a specific role in Knesset Yisrael, meaning he's transmitting to each of the children their role, their responsibility. It doesn't mean he commanded them. It doesn't mean he commanded his sons, Tziv Litzavos Esbanav. No, what it means is that he transmitted his values, his dreams, his aspirations, and their ability to impact Klal Yisrael. It's a transmission. HaTorah v'Mitzvah, the Torah Shebichsav, and the transmission of the oral law, the Torah Shebal Peh. So it says the following, okay? Vayedaber Yosef el beis paro lemor, imna matzasi chen beinechem, dabru no bozne paro lemor. Avi hishbiani lemor, hine anochi meis, bikivri asher karisi li be'eretz kenan, shama tikmareini, v'gomer. So Joseph says, I don't mean any disrespect. I'm not trying to do this as a disrespect to the Pharaoh or to Egypt, but my father commanded. He charged me with the responsibility that he wanted to be buried with his wife Leah, with his parents, with his grandparents. So it's Avi Hishbiani. He made me swear. He made me take an oath that I would return his body to Israel. The following incident, it explains the significance of this exchange. Baron Edmund de Rothschild, the well-known French philanthropist, He wanted to be buried in Israel, but his wish could not be immediately acted upon because of the hostilities related to the 1948 War of Independence. Although he was buried in France, when conditions in Israel permitted, Rothschild's children made a request through the French Interior Ministry that he would be reinterred in Israel. Time passed and they did not receive a reply. After some inquiries, they were told that President Charles de Gaulle himself was delaying the response. When asked, de Gaulle responded that he was troubled by the request. He had considered Baron Edmund de Rothschild a loyal Frenchman. A true Frenchman is born, lives, and dies, and is buried on French soil. Rothschild's request was therefore troubling, and although de Gaulle eventually acceded to the family's request, his opinion of the family Rothschild as Frenchmen was irrevocably diminished. Joseph's dilemma was similar. He had spent many years as a viceroy of Egypt and was considered a true Egyptian. How could he possibly want to have his father buried in a foreign land? Joseph therefore wished to communicate to the Pharaoh that it was because he took an oath to his father that he was compelled to accede to Jacob's wish. The next piece is when Joseph says to his brothers, after they beg forgiveness, Hasachas Elokim ani? Am I in place of God? Asking forgiveness of God and asking forgiveness of another human being, these are fundamentally different categories of request. They require different approaches and different wording. The brother's exhortation, Ana, sana pesha achecha, please, please bear the sin of your brothers. This was phrased in wording similar to that of the Kohen Gadol, Ana kaperna, a vidui that can only properly be addressed to God. Such phrasing is inappropriate in a request for mechila of a fellow human being. Since the vidui wording connotes absolute self-indictment, indicating that God is completely right while the sinner is completely wrong. In disputes between one human being and another, employing such absolutes is improper. In asking mechila of a fellow man, one should word the request for forgiveness differently. I did wrong, please forgive me. Because the brothers addressed Yosef using the language of vidui, Joseph responded that it was inappropriate for them to address him in this way, since such phrasing is reserved for God alone. Hasachas Elokim ani, am I in place of God? Although, according to the Torah, there's a prescription of an eye for an eye, the literal meaning is ayin tachas ayin. However, the Torah Shebaal Peh, the real meaning, interprets this statement to signify monetary compensation only, not an eye for an eye. Why is the wording in the written law so misleading? Because there is, in fact, no true restitution for causing the loss of an eye. On a strictly moral plane, the offender indeed deserves retaliation in kind for imparting such incalculable pain and suffering. On a practical level, however, no Beis Din, no court is allowed to impose such a penalty. Thus, when the brothers express concern that Joseph would retaliate in kind for his years of slavery and exile, Joseph responded that such vengeance can only be exacted by God. On a judicial level, such a verdict is halachically precluded. Asachas Elokim ani. The last two pieces that we're going to do today from the Rav, when it describes that Gam b'nei Machir ben Menashe yuldul al birkei Yosef, that Joseph literally raised his great-grandchildren. The Ibn Ezra explains the verse to mean that Yosef taught his grandchildren Torah. Today we experience what is popularly referred to as a generation gap. Children find no meaning in their parents' experiences. They have difficulty identifying with people and events that took place only 20 years earlier. While the differences between generations generally grow with the number of generations that have passed, when the grandfather is the grandchildren's teacher, a close connection is formed between the generations, with the Torah becoming the bond that links them. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi amplifies this theme through his interpretation of the Pasuk, Vodatam levanecha v'livnei vanecha, yom asher amadata livnei Hashem b'chorev. You know, you have an obligation to transmit not only to your children, but your grandchildren, your great children, your great grandchildren, the day you stood before Hashem at Chorev. Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi asserts that whoever teaches his grandson Torah is considered as if he himself received the Torah from Har Sinai. Although one has a greater obligation to teach one's children than one's grandchildren in terms of the basic mitzvah of Vishinantam Levanecha, but Rabbi Yoshua's statement can be interpreted that as far as receiving the Torah from Sinai, that is the transmission of the Masorah is concerned, grandchildren may indeed take precedence over children. A father can never be certain that his children will transmit his Masorah to their children. When a grandfather teaches his grandchildren directly, then he is guaranteeing that the chain of Masorah will continue. So Yosef said, Pakod yivkod elokim eschem, valisem es atzmosai mizeh. God will surely remember you. And when he does, please take my bones out of here. The viceroy of Egypt, the ruler who by his smallest gesture had the power to judge his brothers for life or death, before whom the brothers begged for their own lives as they pledged eternal subjugation to him, now that same viceroy makes an amazing request. The all-powerful Joseph was utterly powerless to accomplish the one objective that mattered most, to assume his place amongst the Shiftei Yisrael, the tribes of Israel, to have his name etched with that of his brothers on the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol. To achieve this goal, Yosef had to be buried in the land of Israel. The commentators ask, why did Joseph not simply assign his two sons, Menashe and Ephraim, the task of his internment? The answer is that Yosef was not only concerned about his final resting place, but about his very legacy. Yosef had been torn from his family, estranged in an Egyptian exile for so long that he required a spiritual realignment with the rest of the Bnei Yisrael. To accomplish this realignment, Yosef had to repair the breach in the relationship with his brothers, a relationship that had been strained since childhood. He somehow had to inculcate love and respect where previously there had been distrust and fear. His legacy had to be redefined and redeemed with acknowledgement by his brothers and their descendants of his pivotal role in the continuity of the Jewish nation. There is a subtle double meaning in Yosef's request, Valisem es atzmosai, you should take my bones up. The removal of my remains from Egypt should elevate, Valisem, my standing from estrangement to an integral constituent of the tribes of Israel. In this way, the antithesis of Joseph's dream came to pass. Joseph figuratively prostrated himself before his own brothers as he begged them to fulfill his dying request. He was now utterly dependent on his brothers to attain his own redemption. On the night when the Jews were ready for their triumphant exodus from Egypt, the Medrash relates that Moshe Rabbeinu himself delayed their departure as he searched for Yosef's coffin. In this way, Moshe acknowledged the importance of Joseph and his spiritual mission as a paragon of Jewish commitment in exile. Yosef had demonstrated that one could identify as a Jew and act in accordance with the Torah, with Jewish values and precepts, both in poverty as a slave and in royal grandeur as the ruler of Egypt. Without Joseph's example as a precedent, the Jews could have not endured the centuries of enslavement in Egypt. And why was Moses so dedicated to this task? The commentators, the Meforshim, suggest this was because it was a grandson of Levi, Joseph's greatest antagonist. Shimon and Levi are brothers. Instruments of violence are their weapons, Yaakov said. Levi was among the greatest of scoffers of Yosef, as when Yosef recounted his dreams. But through Levi's great descendant Moshe, Levi vicariously acknowledged his mistake. The Talmud comments on the phrase, and Moshe took Yosef's bones with him in his abode. Moshe was not only physically carried Yosef's coffin, but Moshe internalized Yosef's legacy. Moshe acknowledged that the entire nation owed their everlasting gratitude to Yosef, not only for their physical well-being, a gratitude that was already expressed, as foretold in the first dream, but also, and perhaps mainly, for Yosef's spiritual leadership and Yosef's examples represented in the second dream. This belated recognition, it constituted the complete fulfillment of the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars were prostrating themselves to me. Could there be a more beautiful example of such obeisance than Moshe carrying Yosef's coffin on his shoulders? Yosef's spiritual mission on earth was now validated, his second dream fulfilled in its entirety.